This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Shares of United Airlines, they are surging. They are up 16%, as Charlie mentioned. That's the most in more than 3 years. You got to go back to November of 2020 to see that kind of a move. This is after the carrier forecast more than better than expected profit this quarter, tempering concerns that Boeing aircraft delays and regulatory pressure will put expansion plans at risk. So that's what's going on with United. We talked about it. We broke those numbers after the close last night.
Yeah. Meantime, Boeing is the subject of two congressional committee hearings today on the company's safety culture in the wake of a near catastrophic accident in January, as well as two crashes of 737 MAX aircraft a few years ago, and also, Carol, on its relationship with regulators.
Yeah, it's a full plate. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from the state of Connecticut, who chairs the second session, congressional session today, says today's hearing is the first of several he weighed in earlier.
There are mounting serious allegations that Boeing has a broken safety culture and a set of practices that are unacceptable. These whistleblowers have come forward at great personal risk.
That was, of course, Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from the state of Connecticut. He chairs the session today. With more on all of it, let's bring in Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Aerospace Defense and Airlines Analyst George Ferguson, who joins us from Arizona. George, first up, I want to talk about Boeing and the hearings today. The hearing this morning was the first of two in Washington today to explore Boeing's safety record. The second panel focused on claims by a Boeing engineer turned whistleblower who alleges that the company has cut corners on the production of its 787 Dreamliner. What do you watch for during events like this? What should our audience watch for during events like this?
So on the Dreamliner specifically, I think what we're watching for is to figure out whether or not this is part of an earlier issue that Boeing had with the 787 with joining the fuselage pieces. They negotiated or discussed with the FAA the right way to fix a shimming problem they had with the airplane. They, you know, what we'd heard is they'd fixed that problem and they had a better process in place to join the aircraft together. So if this is part of that same issue, then I'd say, you know, for investors, then there's nothing here. If it's an additional issue with the 787 and not that shimming problem, then I'd be concerned, right? Then it's going to be additional costs for Boeing, and it could lead to concerns about, you know, safety and flying the airplane.
You know, I think about it and just watching all of the issues that have kind of hit Boeing over the last few years, it's like, why are they having these problems? And I do wonder, George, if you think these committee hearings will help get to the bottom of it, especially when one of the things that lawmakers are concerned about is that the FAA has been too soft on the company. And I'm curious if you could weigh in on that, if you agree that maybe Boeing has been too cozy with its regulators.
Yeah, I think even more than cozy, right? So the sense I really get is the relationship between Boeing and the regulator, the FAA, for many, many years has been one of Boeing being in a superior position. I think they Boeing probably had more engineering talent than the FAA. And I think they, you know, sort of told the FAA what they thought was needed rather than had a sort of a one-on-one balanced relationship with the FAA, and that's clearly going to have to change. The FAA has had its challenges too through the pandemic. They've had a lot of turnover. They've lost some talent there as well. They have to backfill, so that creates more. You know, that creates a problem too with the with that whole relationship. So I mean, I think, you know, again, I think we've heard this previously. We've also heard previously from the FAA mm-hmm. that the safety systems at Boeing were broken, that people, you know, were incentivized not to speak up. They're incentivized not, you know, if they spoke up, they would potentially be, you know, have some sort of recourse brought against them. If people were concerned about safety over moving aircraft through through production. So I think Congress is getting to something that we already know,
yeah.
but Congress is probably rightfully concerned because this is the most important aerospace company, aerospace manufacturer, you know, fuselage manufacturer in the country.
So this is a good part of the process to getting to the bottom of what's wrong at Boeing, in your view. This should result in getting to the bottom of it.
I guess I'd like to see, I'm going to look for more out of the FAA.
Okay.
And its investigations. You know, congressional hearings can get a little bit
political. Jinx.
So there's going to be some grandstanding and things like that, right? But I think Congress is rightfully, you know, expressing their view that, hey, something is broken and we want due attention paid to it, and it needs to be fixed. It's in the best interest of the country. Along that road, we'll get, you know, some political actors in the whole game.
Okay, George, so let's think about potential outcomes here post FAA investigation, given that we've already seen leadership turnover at Boeing. The CEO, Dave Calhoun, is on his way out by the end of the year. We saw reshuffling of executive ranks there as well. So what could potential outcomes be post FAA investigation? Like, what could repercussions be?
So I don't know what repercussions, and I haven't really sort of dialed into my analysis repercussions. What I've more dialed into my analysis is, you know, adjustments to the Boeing production process. And that is going to include, I think, a lot more oversight, both from the FAA. And I think the FAA is going to expect Boeing to do a better job of overseeing the factory floors and ensuring safety and quality, which I think is going to slow things down. But it's important. You got to build quality products in aerospace or nobody's going to trust your product. And I think it's interesting that the FAA did give the exercise to Boeing to propose how they were going to improve it, because, you know, I guess they can sort of scrutinize from there what Boeing comes up with. And it'll be interesting to see if they have additional measures they want to put on top of it. But I think a lot of it's going to be training and oversight.
All right. Let's talk about United, because, man, this stock is up 16%, the most since November of 2020 in terms of the size of the jump that we're seeing. Earnings came out after the close yesterday. A lot of it has to do with the outlook, but tell us how you see it and how you look at this quarter. And they, of course, were dealing with some of those challenges that Boeing has been dealing with because of the grounding of planes and so on.
Yeah, so I guess the way I look at United is it was a nice quarter. I totally agree. I think they did more premium seat sales this quarter. They've been, you know, these airplanes they've been taking delivery of, they're larger aircraft, they're aircraft that have premium seats in it. Right now in the marketplace, you want to be offering premium seats. I think there's maybe a little too much basic economy seating, but there's not enough premium, it appears. And that, I think that helped drive the quarter. I would note that when we look at the yields they're making on, for example, their domestic business, their yields came up, you know, a couple, I think it was almost 3%, where Delta was flattish. But the absolute yield, which is the price paid, you know, per mile, but the price the customer pays per mile flown, if you look at the actual yields, they're still beneath Delta for United, which tells me that there's more room to grow, which I think the market is probably responding to, more room to grow those premium offerings to get better yields out of it. And I think that's a lot of what's going on here. Now, obviously, Boeing's problems are going to mean less aircraft delivery for United this year, although they appear to be tapped into A321s from Airbus. So they'll continue to increase the size of their aircraft, which improves their efficiency and, again, allows them these premium seats up front that they can command a better price for. And I think that's working for them. They're closing that gap. I would note, too, real quick, that United is still valued, if I just look at it quickly, on a PE ratio, they're still valued below Delta. So that, I think that's what you're seeing a reaction to in the marketplace.
George, how should investors think about the FAA review that's already begun at this point regarding safety incidents for United?
The FAA has a lot of reviews going on, right?
And yeah, so, it really does.
And look, again, all important. I think the regulator has been through a couple rough years during the pandemic, and hopefully this means they're getting their footing underneath them and getting out and influencing these marketplaces or these industries. United has every incentive to do the utmost for safety inside their network. I think they had a spate of challenges. I think there's been a lot of turnover at all the airlines during the pandemic, and the maintenance turnover is hard because you got to train new people. You got to make sure they're very thorough. My guess is we're going to find out is that turnover created the problem. But I would expect that, maybe there's some processes that United has to tighten up. But I think you're going to find out it's an employee turnover issue, and that in time this gets better as people are more trained and understand their job better and turnover goes down.
All right. Great stuff. So appreciate you weighing in. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Aerospace Defense and Airlines Analyst George Ferguson joining us from Arizona. We mentioned shares of United up about 16% here, the most in terms of the percentage gain since we've seen going all the way back to November of 2020. But the whole airline sector, Tim, looking at the S&P 500 Super Composite Airline Index, it is up almost 5% in today's session.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, earlier this year, Bloomberg News reporting stress on the nation's electric grids is accelerating at an unprecedented clip. Demand is climbing just as aging infrastructure strains under the massive overhaul needed to adapt to renewable energy. The convergence is making it harder to maintain safe, reliable power quality, and some regulators and utilities are not tracking the problem.
All right, and so last fall, the Department of Energy announced up to $3.5 billion in funding to upgrade the U.S. grid. This topic among the many at this week's Bloomberg NEF Annual Energy and Climate Summit. Our next guest participated in a panel at the event. It was entitled Leveraging Largest Ever Grid Investment to Enhance Resilience. So there is a lot going on. With us in the studio to talk about the nation's grid is Maria Robinson. She's Director of the Grid Deployment Office at the U.S. Department of Energy. I feel like I don't even need to ask you how bad is the grid, because I feel like we do stories on it all the time about how bad it is. But how bad is it really?
So we're facing a lot of different problems here on the grid today, right? You are talking about we have new demand. It's great that we're bringing manufacturing back to the United States, but that's a strain on the electric grid. The electric grid is aging. It's not just older than me, it's older than my grandparents. So then we're looking at ways that we need to upgrade our existing infrastructure while continuing to build new ones. I think of it, we released a report just yesterday on advanced and innovative grid deployment mechanisms of being able to take advantage of some of the existing infrastructure and figuring out ways at relatively low cost to upgrade what we currently have. The joke that I make is,
so we cannot do upgrades. It's not like a massive rebuild.
Right. We have to do both. Okay. We are definitely going to have to continue to build in order to meet all the demands, but we can take advantage of those existing rights of way, right? We don't have to deal with as much permitting, which we all know is a really difficult topic to deal with. But oftentimes folks are taking our existing lines and replacing the metal part that's inside of it. It's called a conductor. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they're just replacing that like for like instead of upgrading it to a newer technology that can move more electrons every single day. And so
it's so funny. There's a story in the Bloomberg. It's probably a connection with this, but it's a century-old transmission line is getting a 21st century upgrade. And it's about a startup that's created a wire that's lighter and can carry up to 3 times more electricity. I mean, we talk about this with battery usage, right, for EVs, about making things, even chips, right, accelerators, making them more productive, making them more energy efficient. Like, this is what it's about.
Exactly. And so all these great technologies are already out there. They're really proven in the field. We just need the market to pick them up.
Is it more of a state issue right now? I mean, I think of states that have struggled with their grids. Texas and California certainly come to mind. Is it a federal issue, or is it a utility issue?
It's all three, it's unfortunately. All of the above. Okay. The fun part about the electric grid is that it doesn't follow political lines, right? We have an Eastern interconnect, a Western interconnect, and they don't follow necessarily. They're like time zones, right? They just sometimes split a state down the middle. So we have to figure out how we mix some federal policy with individual state policy. Some states are really looking to decarbonize, and the way they want to build their grid might be different than their neighbor who has different goals, ultimately. And so we're trying to mix and match all of those different priorities in order to make sure that we have a strong grid that can withstand anything.
There's nothing like a federal incentive or a tax break or something to get us to do something, whether you're a company, whether you're an individual. So what are the incentives that you guys or that utilities need to actually adopt better technologies and some of the technologies that you guys are talking about?
So there are certainly some ways from the regulatory structure that utility commissioners at the state level or at the federal level could incentivize the use of some of these different technologies.
Should they? Do we need to really make it happen?
I think we need to make a bit of a push here just because we have so much to deal with over the next 3 to 5 years. And that's when we can deploy some of these technologies while we're still building out major transmission lines that, you know, take 10 to 12 years.
Is this a national security issue?
It certainly is a national security issue, and this is something that we continue to face every day. Our grid is one of our greatest assets that we have in our country, and making sure that we can withstand cybersecurity attacks, physical attacks, and just, frankly, weather. One of the biggest issues is wildfires and making sure that we can prevent those from happening moving forward.
Yeah, we were talking about this, another story that's on the Bloomberg today, that's about that, you know, how investors have looked at the debt at utilities is kind of a sure thing in the past, right, in terms of investing. But because of what's happening with climate change, that is not necessarily the case, that there's a lot more questions that are out there in terms of the unpredictability and the costs that are mounting at some of the nation's utilities.
And I think part of this is trying to incentivize utilities, and they're really coming around to realize this. You're not going to, if a pole gets knocked down from 150 mile an hour winds, you're not going to replace it with another pole like was there before that could get knocked down. You want something that can withstand 250 mile an hour winds. And so we have to make sure that the regulatory structure is there in place to allow them to think in a forward leaning way.
What can I just ask you? So what is that regulatory structure?
So there are these very fun organizations called utility commissions, public utility commissions. They're the people who decide how much you pay on your electricity bill and on your gas bill. And those are the folks that hold utilities accountable and also figure out how those costs are being allocated to regular folks like us and to major industry as well.
How much are we talking here? If you could wave a magic wand and get enough funding to completely upgrade the grid in the U.S., how much would it be?
So we are really lucky under the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act. Right, my office has about $22 billion to upgrade the grid. We talked about $3.5 billion of it going out last year. To be honest, that's a drop in the bucket. Hmm. Every year, utilities spend about $23 billion just to maintain their existing assets in order to continue to upgrade. What we do find, though, is that some of those costs could just be shifted. Instead of paying to replace like for like, we could be paying a slightly lower cost even to do some of those upgrades. And that's where we have to continue to push the market as much as possible.
So is 20 plus billion dollars enough?
20 plus billion, I think, per year. But, you know, we're blessed with having Inflation Reduction Act money and bipartisan infrastructure law. Of course, that expires after a period of time.
Is there a chance that we're all going to end up paying as users, consumers, that to, in other words, to help pay for this, that we are going to pay higher utility costs?
I think if folks are smart and we do good planning and we think years out and make sure that we're being preventative about it, that we're not going to bear the cost. Think about how much it costs for recovery after a major storm. If the lights go out, how many billions of dollars of revenue is lost.
And yet here we are. So what hope do you have that it kind of changes?
I do have a lot of hope. I think that folks are really this issue is coming to a head.
Okay.
For the first time, at least in my career, folks are really realizing that our grid needs a lot of investment. Everyone focuses on the generation side. They're excited about new plants and new gas and new solar and new wind.
I hate to end on this, but what's one scenario that keeps you up at night?
Oh, there are a lot of scenarios that keep me up at night. Hurricane season keeps me up at night. Yeah. Hurricane season absolutely keeps me up at night. And so we just want to make sure that we can invest in our grid as much as possible to make sure that instead of the lights going out for 5 hours, they only go out for 5 minutes.
Well, Maria Robinson, thank you so much. Reality check there. Director of the Grid Deployment Office at the U.S. Department of Energy.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, Lime is the operator of a shared e-bike and scooter network. It's backed by Uber, and it's seeing its business growing. Bloomberg News reports that the privately held company is planning to invest more than $55 billion this year to expand its global fleet and add more than 30,000 net new bikes across North America, Europe, and Australia, while also replacing aging ones. That story last week by Bloomberg's Natalie Young. We've got with us Wayne Ting, the CEO of Lime. He joins us from New York. Wayne, good to have you with us this afternoon. Really interesting to see this story, especially at a time when the micromobility industry has hit so many speed bumps. I mean, we're talking about Bird Global and its bankruptcy, Super Pedestrian shutting U.S. operations, Lyft owns City Bike, popular here in New York City. It's been looking for a strategic partner or to sell its bike sharing business. Why is the story of Lime different right now?
Yeah, I actually think the story of Lime is different for because we've really focused in on the things that truly matter. I think every company has to decide, what are the two or three things that allow you to win customers, differentiate from competitors, and grow profitability? And for our industry, the three things that matter are, one, the quality and durability of hardware; two, best-in-class operation enabled by technology; and three, our relationships with cities and governments. And across all three of these things, Lime has been the best-in-class on all of them. On hardware, for example, all of our competitors buy off-the-shelf Chinese hardware. They've outsourced the scooters and e-bikes. Every scooter and e-bike at Lime, we've developed in-house, and we manufacture with our controlled manufacturing partners. What this means is that we get to design them so that we can focus on the things that riders care about. And whenever there's a issue with a bike or scooter, we can make quick changes to the next production line to improve it. If one of the challenge, when there's a big conflict of interest when you buy off-the-shelf scooters and bikes, if my business is to sell you more scooters and bikes, I have very little incentive to make them last as long as possible and to use as few spare parts as possible. So over the last 5 years, while Lime scooters and bikes have continued to improve in our reliability and durability, our scooters and bikes on average last more than 5 years. From just over a month 5 years ago, our competitors have not seen that type of improvements in hardware. And in the course of the last 5 years, our P&L and financial results have completely diverged.
So
because of these investments.
So you are profitable, correct?
Yes, last year we delivered over $90 million of adjusted EBITDA, which is up 5x versus 2022.
What's your outlook in terms of our expectations when it comes to growth going forward, and what is fueling growth top and bottom line?
Yeah, so 2023, our top line grew by 32%. It's actually our third year in a row of 30%+ growth. And we expect to see that level of growth continue to the future. So Tim, you mentioned that we're gonna make a 50+ our investments in e-bikes because we're seeing huge demand from riders and cities for more e-bikes all around the world. Last year, while our top line grew by 32%, our e-bike business doubled. And we're seeing this all throughout the world. And part of the major reason is because cities have committed to transition their transportation system towards a green transportation future. And as we're seeing with electric cars, sales are not hitting expectations. The only way for us to hit our Paris Climate Accord goals is to drastically reduce our reliance on cars. And Lime's e-bike fleet is a good way and often a cheaper way for riders to access electric bikes all around the world.
But when I go back to what Tim, you know, said, you know, Bird Global went bankrupt, Super Pedestrian shutting U.S. operations, thinking about the sale of its European business. This is according to TechCrunch. And then you got Citibike that was looking for a strategic partner. It is interesting. It feels like the challenges, and one of the challenges is banned. I'm curious what's your approach to policy given some of the recent e-scooter bans? And I do wonder, too, within your business, what's growing more? Is it scooters or is it bikes?
Bikes is actually growing faster than the scooters. So we are actually not seeing a lot of bans. There was one decision in Paris to exit scooters from Paris. But since then, we've actually doubled our e-bike fleet in Paris as Paris is looking for green transportation ahead of the Olympics. And we now have more e-bikes on the streets of Paris than we did with scooters before the so-called scooter ban. And since then, we've seen no other city follow suit. In fact, we see every single city we work with either extend or expand their scooter e-bike operation. So we're seeing the opposite effect, which is cities are actually adopting micromobility faster with time.
I'm wondering I want to ask a little bit about new vehicle types here, because there are also some new areas that you're working on, including new vehicle types, also a new business line when it comes to advertising. Starting with advertising, what do you have planned there?
So I think one of the differences between Lime's business model and traditional docked bike. So you all mentioned Motivate from Lyft. If you look at traditional docked bike businesses,
that's the parent company of Citibike.
Yeah, the only profitable part of the business is the advertising business, and they typically. And so one of the big differences for Lime is that we actually make money in our core operations. And so when we look at the advertising business, it's a proven business model for a lot of bike share businesses. We've just never historically tapped into it. But if we do go into it, it will be additive to the core business. Because I think one of the challenges a lot of these businesses have done is that they have not improved their core operations, and they simply relied on advertising to make up for losses in their core operations. That is not what Lime is doing. We make money in our core e-bike, e-scooter rental, and we see advertising as a add-on to our core business.
And what about those new vehicle types, these new accessible vehicles that you're piloting in some areas of the world right now?
Yes, I think one of the advantages that Lime has, because we have an internal hardware team, is that we get to experiment with lots of different hardware modes. And one of the things we learned with the e-bikes versus the e-scooter is that different types of hardware types can appeal to different riders differently. So for example, bikes, we see a more gender balance between women and men, and a slightly older ridership than scooters, which are probably a little bit younger and more men than women.
That's because we're afraid of so as we're as we're investing on a scooter. More, just gonna say.
So as we're investing more hardware, we're also looking at how do we expand the appeal of micromobility to more riders, different age groups, different use cases. And so you'll continue to see us invest in new hardware form factors.
What does that look like?
Yeah.
It's not a bike, it's not a scooter. What is it?
Come on, so you can share with us.
So the way we think about this is that the target trips length for Lime trips is trips under 5 miles.
Yeah.
60% of car trips are under 5 miles. And then so our question is, what do people do on these trips? They can go to the grocery stores, go to work, go to school, go visit a family. And what can't we do today? So for example, if you want to go to a grocery store, you have your groceries on you, it's hard to ride back in a scooter. But in our e-bikes, we have a basket, and it's a good place to put the groceries or whatever things you've bought. So we're going to continue to look at, right now, if it gets very cold, or if it rains, it becomes harder to use an e-bike or e-scooter. Are there ways we can make Lime scooters and bikes usable during rain and even during winter? And people typically don't want to use those for longer distances.
Yeah.
But can we make a mode that is good for long distance travel as well?
Wayne,
so the way we think about this.
Yeah, go ahead, please. No, finish your thought, please.
Please, Carol.
No.
What we think about is how do we continue to tackle different use cases that riders may want to use micromobility for?
Pretty cool. Looking forward to it. When you want to share more, draw us a picture. We would love to know. Hey, got 30 seconds left here. Do you have to go public, though, to fuel the expansion and growth that you're talking about ultimately? And just quickly, if you could.
We don't need to go public to fuel this. So one of the big reasons why we're investing $50 million when all of our competitors in the industry is pulling back is because We actually generated nearly $100 million of EBITDA that we can leverage to invest in our growth and expansion.
Right.
Lime is profitable and self-sustaining. So we're at a point where we don't need to raise more money. In fact, I think one of the problems with the industry, like I would say with the VC industry generally, is that there's been so much cheap money coming in.
Right.
And then there's been a growth at all costs against a drive towards profitability. This is actually bad for business because bad companies don't go away. They just go raise more cheap capital.
Okay.
So that's not how we want to run our business. And we don't need to go public to fund our growth.
Okay.
We generate enough profits to fund our capital.
Okay. 5 seconds though. Do you want to go public?
Of course.
Okay. That's all I needed to know. Hey, Wayne, thank you so much. Look forward to next time. Wayne Ting, he's the CEO at Lime.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It's that time already, Carol, that we drive to the close. Do you believe it?
Yeah, I do believe it. And kind of an interesting tone today, and we're trying to make sense of it because we have seen yields back off a little bit. Of course, kind of a reassessment following Jay Powell's comments yesterday. But you've got a 10-year note, 4.58.
Okay.
And a 2-year note below 5 at 4.93. So we moved up. moved down from what we've saw kind of some earlier in the session.
Abigail Doolittle, our chief markets correspondent, essentially saying earlier that equities are catching up to what yields have been telling us. We also talked a little bit about AI early on in our program today, which is kind of where I want to start with our next guest, because he says that when it comes to AI, the early winners and losers may seem obvious, but the truth is that we are just getting started. Those are the words of Aaron Cannon, who's the co-founder and CEO at Clear Harbor Asset Management. They've got more than $1.5 billion in assets under management. Aaron joins us once again from Stamford, Connecticut. Aaron, how are you?
Doing great, Tim. Thanks for having me back.
Hey, good to have you back with us. I do want to start with AI, and we'll get to markets in just a second. But, you know, it's something we talk about all the time. Of course, the winners are very clear. When you say we're just getting started, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, AI has been with us for a long time. We have begun to focus on it in sort of the sort of popular landscape of, you know, how is it impacting certain aspects of our life? And I just think, you know, like many things, we have to be careful as investors to chase certain themes, because there will be probably many winners, but also perhaps many more losers. And I think we're in the early innings of the AI revolution. Like I said, that has been ongoing for a long time. I mean, Andy Jassy over at Amazon was articulating this last week in his annual letter. We even heard it from bank CEO Jamie Dimon. We're hearing it from the behemoths on the consumer staple side, like Procter and Gamble, and even utilities. And so, AI is a broad theme. I think in the news, we've tend to focus on it just in the context of technology and software.
Well, it's funny that you say that. I think it was also David Solomon over at Goldman who said something to the effect of AI. Yeah, all of the investment. Well, we're thinking about, you know, all the financing that's going to be need to make that investment in AI. So it is interesting. And I have to say, as we go through earnings, we joke a little bit because it just feels like every earnings release or every, you know, C-suite on their calls is somehow sprinkling it into the conversation. So it's like it does feel a little kind of funny at times. Having said that, though, how do you think about it? Because it does feel like, you know, we did a story about Microsoft and using it to help with coding, and it's made a lot of advancements using ChatGPT, right? OpenAI's ChatGPT, to actually make advancements in coding and helping its software engineers. So being put to use. So how do you, Aaron, you know, figure out, okay, what's the smart part of this trend where I want to position my clients and my investors?
It's a great question. I mean, it's a challenging one to answer in a few seconds for sure. But suffice it to say, we're going to see major productivity gains, and that'll accrue positively to the bottom line, perhaps provide better balance sheets for many companies and employment challenges for particular segments of the economy. This has happened time and time again as we moved into the age of the internet in the 2000s, as we moved from horse and buggy to an automobile, and we're going to see challenges, but also opportunities within AI. But it is you point to something quite interesting, which is some engineers are being laid off because they're creating artificial intelligence that reacts and acts in the way that a human engineer would act. And so you maybe a few months ago you think, well, engineers are going to be in high demand, and that certainly may still be the case, but they're also being somewhat, perhaps in a year or two, that they could be disintermediated by AI itself, which is really an interesting thought.
Well, if you go back, right, even a couple of years or something, we're like, hey, kids, you know, or hey, parents, tell your kids they should go be coders, right? Because we're all going to need it because everything is digitized, if you will. So it is fascinating to see how the narrative has quickly changed. Having said that, the narrative around what the Fed may do has changed dramatically. And we've seen that representation in dramatic moves when it comes to U.S. Treasury yields. And it impacts everything, the U.S. dollar, it's gold. Gold, you were watching, Tim teased ahead of you coming on about gold up about 15% so far this year. You look at gold, is it something that's investable for you and your clients?
Absolutely. It's been a really interesting year, and it's only, of course, April, to see the dollar move up, call it 5%, and gold, which tends to move in inverse to the dollar, up 15%. It suggests to me that there are other things happening in the marketplace. And I would argue, although the data is a little less than transparent on this point, that emerging market central banks are certainly are most likely the culprits behind the bid up in the gold market. We've seen some evidence that China is the most significant buyer of gold at the moment. And I think there are a couple of reasons for this. One is we're seeing more non-dollar transactions occurring in the midst of this sort of Ukraine war and friction with China. You have China trading energy and commodities with Russia in renminbi. You have Russia trading oil with India in rupees. And so I think it's sort of putting into question the degree to which the dollar will remain the prevailing lead currency in the world. I mean, certainly that trend is still in place. The dollar is the global reserve currency, but it's trended downward from, I don't know, 75 to 80% maybe in 1950 to below 60% today. And that trend probably will continue declining into the future. And I think that's, you know, part of what's going on the gold front. The other big point here, too, is that our fiscal house is not in order. And the last time we had interest rates where they are today on a 2-year rolling basis was back about 17 years ago when our debt to GDP was 60%. And today it's over 120%. So the notion that, you know, the dollar is in good stead relative to gold is being put into question. And there are, of course, many other variables to talk about there, but those are some of the key ones that come to mind.
Well, Aaron, we only have 30 seconds left, but I do want to talk about today's market, the S&P 500 on track for a close, 4 days, 4 days of decline, if it does indeed close lower, with it, which it looks like it will do. Buying opportunity right now?
I think in the long run, you want to own well-managed, well-positioned equities for sure. But if you look at the breadth of the market, which had been widening out going into the end of the quarter, it's not any longer. If you look at the top four names in the market that have led the rally of 6% in the S&P, Tim, NVIDIA, Meta, Microsoft, and Amazon, they represent 72% of the current year-to-date return of 6%. Wow. You know, last year, that number was 43%. The top four names led only 43% of the total return. And so it's certainly a narrow rally. But if you look beneath the hood at the broader S&P, at the broader market, it's cheaper. It's only trading at 16 times.
We got to run. Aaron Kennan over at Clear Harbor Asset Management. This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.